You are listening to a recording made available by the Friends of Israel Gospel Ministry Incorporated as a service to God's people. This is message number 6 of 12 on the Book of Daniel by Dr. Reynold Showers. This message is entitled, God's Sovereign Rule Over Gentile Law.
Jehovah has been known for centuries as the God of the people of Israel. And in the last 5 chapters of the book of Daniel, Jehovah demonstrates his sovereign rule over the people of Israel. But in chapters 2-7, he demonstrates his sovereign rule over the Gentiles, as well as Israel. We've been noting that God has demonstrated his sovereign rule over Gentile empires, Gentile punishment, Gentile rulers, and Gentile defenses. But as we come in this particular session to Daniel chapter 6, we have God demonstrating his sovereign rule over Gentile law. We noted in our last session that on the night of October 13th, 539 B.C., the great capital city, Babylon, of the Babylonian Empire fell to the Medo-Persians. And with the fall of the capital city, the Babylonian Empire collapsed and now was incorporated into the Medo-Persian Empire, the next great Gentile power in ancient history. This meant that there was going to be a change of rulership, not only for the Babylonian people who were now absorbed into this new Gentile empire, but a change of rulership even for those Jewish men who had been carried captive from their homeland of Palestine to the land of Babylon. In the very last verse of Daniel chapter 5, Daniel tells us who the new Gentile ruler is. He says, "So Darius the Mede received the kingdom at about the age of 62. And right away again, we are confronted with a mystery, a problem that is very similar to that of the identification of Belshazzar in Daniel chapter 5. We noted in our last session that we are told in Daniel chapter 5 that the last king of Babylon was Belshazzar. But for centuries, none of the Babylonian royal records that were available to scholars ever referred to a king by the name of Belshazzar. But we noted in our last session that during the 1920s, more royal clay tablets of ancient Babylon were uncovered, and they solved the mystery of this man, Belshazzar. We have a similar mystery with regard to Darius the Mede. Up until now, there has been no ancient record of the Medo-Persians that names any ruler, any king, by the name of Darius. And so again, the question is, who is this man? Skeptics have said it's a mistake. The writer of the book of Daniel didn't know his history. He made a mistake. There was no such ruler. However, in the 1950s, Dr. John C. Whitcomb, who was on the faculty of Grace Theological Seminary in Winona Lake, Indiana, published a very fine book, very scholarly treatment, entitled Darius the Mede. It has received great recognition, not only in evangelical Bible-believing circles, but by scholars outside of evangelical Bible-believing circles. Dr. Whitcomb has proposed and has given some very substantial evidence for concluding that this is the case, that the name Darius is not the personal name of this man of Media who began to rule Babylon on behalf of the Medo-Persian Empire. Dr. Whitcomb proposes that the name Darius was actually a title of a ruler, similar to the title Caesar for the rulers of the Roman Empire many centuries later. Many different men who ruled over Rome had an official title of Caesar, and then their personal name might be added after that official title. Dr. Whitcomb has indicated that many of the ancient Persian records indicate that after Babylon had fallen to the Medo-Persian Empire and had been incorporated into that new Gentile empire, King Cyrus, the Medo-Persian king, appointed a man whose personal name was Gobryas. His name is listed in those ancient Persian records as the man who was appointed by King Cyrus to govern what used to be the Babylonian Empire, but was now part of the Medo-Persian Empire. We do know from the Persian records that now that the Medo-Persian Empire was expanding and becoming so huge in size, for the sake of administrative efficiency, King Cyrus subdivided the empire into divisions and appointed men as sub-kings underneath his rule to administer each of these divisions on his behalf. And the personal name of the man who was appointed to be the sub-king under Cyrus, but ruling over ancient Babylon in the Medo-Persian Empire, was this man by the name of Gobryas. And many scholars are convinced that Dr. Whitcomb has solved the mystery of who Darius the Mede was. Now, with this as background, we come to the first division of Daniel chapter 6, and this is contained in verses 1 through 3, and we could entitle this Daniel's position under Darius the Mede. Daniel writes, verse 1, "It seemed good to Darius to appoint 120 satraps over the kingdom, that they should be in charge of the whole kingdom, and over them three commissioners, of whom Daniel was one, that these satraps might be accountable to them, and that the king might not suffer loss. Then this Daniel began distinguishing himself among the commissioners and satraps, because he possessed an extraordinary spirit, and the king planned to appoint him over the entire kingdom." Now keep in mind again, Darius, or if you want to use his possible personal name, Gobryas, was responsible for administering what used to be the Babylonian Empire, but which is now just part of the greater Medo-Persian Empire. And again, to be administratively efficient, he subdivided his part of the Medo-Persian Empire into divisions, evidently 120 divisions, called satrapies, and he appointed 120 men called satraps to administer each of those divisions under him. We are told in verse 2 that one of the responsibilities of the satraps was to make sure that the king did not suffer loss. This was referring to financial loss. We had seen in one of our earlier sessions that according to the ancient Medo-Persian records, the Medo-Persian Empire had developed a fantastic internal revenue service, an outstanding system for collecting taxes from the subjects of that particular kingdom. And the idea here is that one of the major responsibilities of the satraps was to collect the taxes from the people of their division of the Babylonian kingdom part of the Medo-Persian Empire. But in order to make sure that those 120 men did their job so that the king would not suffer loss, Darius appointed three other men over the 120 satraps, and he called those three other men commissioners. And it was the job of the commissioners to look after the 120 satraps and make sure that they did their job properly of administering their division. In the providence of God, Daniel was one of those three commissioners placed in authority over the 120 satraps. And it would appear from verse 3 that through time, Daniel had distinguished himself so well in carrying out his responsibilities that Darius the Mede was planning to put Daniel in ultimate authority over all the other officials in Babylon within the Medo-Persian Empire. Now, I'm certain that the other two commissioners and the 120 satraps somewhere along the line learned of the king's plan, that eventually Daniel would even be put in authority over them. And this lays the foundation for what is about to transpire. But before we see what was about to transpire, I'd like to point out something rather interesting. Rather amazing that Daniel is doing such an extraordinary job in some respects, or at least is being elevated, because he would be very close to 80 years of age at this particular time. And he's still going strong and doing a great job administratively. And here again is the sovereignty of God. Once again, even though there's been a tremendous change of rulership and kingdom, once again, God in his sovereignty moving his man into a key position of leadership where God can use him again to demonstrate who is the true and the living God over the affairs of man on planet Earth. 80 years of age, what is the secret to his stamina and his ability? Well, according to verse 3, it's because he had an extraordinary spirit. And indeed he did. He had the Spirit of God working with him and enabling him, because he was a prophet of God, a servant of God. That leads us to the second major division of Daniel chapter 6. And this begins with verse 4 and goes to verse 9. And we could entitle this the official's plot. The official's plot, verses 4 through 9. We read verse 4, then the commissioners and satraps began trying to find a ground of accusation against Daniel in regard to government affairs. As the other two commissioners and the 120 satraps learned that King Darius was planning to put Daniel in authority over them, they got jealous. Keep in mind, probably these other 122 rulers were pagan Gentiles. Daniel was a Jew. And typical of pagan Gentiles, who throughout history have been characterized by anti-Semitism, they could not tolerate or accept the idea that a Jew who belonged to a conquered people would ever be put in a position of authority over them. And they are jealous. And here comes Gentile anti-Semitism out into the open again. And they begin to plot. We've got to get rid of this man, Daniel. And typical politicians, they figured they knew how. Evidently, knowing what they've been like as politicians, they figured all they had to do was dig into Daniel's political past, and certainly there would be some skeletons sitting in the closet. Certainly somewhere in his past as a government official, he had been corrupt. Maybe taken bribes. Maybe he had made swung decisions in favor of friends at the expense of the government or other people. Or perhaps he'd been dishonest in some other way. And so they began to spy into his past and left no stone unturned to uncover some scandal about Daniel. But to their chagrin, it was totally fruitless. The record tells us, verse 4, they could find no ground of accusation or evidence of corruption, inasmuch as he was faithful, and no negligence or corruption was to be found in him. Would to God we had men like that in government today. What a difference it would make. Daniel was a man of God. He'd been faithful. He'd been honest in his dealings. He refused to allow himself to be compromised or corrupted as a government official. And these men had to give up in using his past record as their tool to get him thrown out of government and a position of authority over them. And they began to get a little desperate. We've got to get rid of this Jew. But how can we do it? They finally decided, let's see if we can use his religion against him. Maybe there's some law of his God that he follows that we can use against him to get him out of his position of governmental authority in the Medo-Persian Empire. And evidently, they began to study the spiritual habits of this man, Daniel. And it would appear that as they studied his daily life, they noted that three times every day, Daniel prayed to Jehovah, the true and living God. And as they thought about that, they devised a scheme. Now we know how to get rid of this man. So, according to verses 5 and 6, they said, we shall not find any ground of accusation against this Daniel unless we find it against him with regard to the law of his God. Then these commissioners and satraps came by agreement. Notice all these men were in agreement on this, 142 men, came by agreement to the king, and spoke to him as follows, King Darius, live forever. All the commissioners of the kingdom, the prefects and the satraps, the high officials and the governors, have consulted together that the king should establish a statute and enforce an injunction that anyone who makes a petition to any god or man besides you, O king, for 30 days, shall be cast into the lion's den. Now, right at the outset, they told a lie. They said all the officials have agreed that this statute ought to be enforced by you for 30 days. That's not true. Daniel was one of the top officials, and in no way had he agreed to this. He hadn't even been in on the consultations on what was to be done. So they lied to the king. They gave him false information. In the approach they made, this would normally make this pagan king feel quite good. It almost appeared as if these officials had his interest at heart. It was another way of elevating the king and concentrating all of the attention of all of his subjects within his kingdom upon him. Again, what they were proposing is pass an official decree to the effect that no one in your realm is to pray to any god or any other man except you, O king, for the next 30 days. And if anyone is discovered violating that law, that person is to be thrown into the den of lions. Evidently, Darius did not take the time to think through some of the possible implications of passing that decree. And he fell for their trap. And according to verse 8 and verse 9, the king signed that decree into law. Verse 8 reads, now, O king, establish the injunction and sign the document so that it may not be changed according to the law of the Medes and Persians, which may not be revoked. Therefore, King Darius signed the document, that is the injunction. And I would like to suggest to you that verse 8 is the key to chapter 6. Notice what these officials said to the king. You established the injunction. You signed the document so that it may not be changed according to the law of the Medes and Persians, which may not be revoked. According to ancient records that come down to us, both from Persian and also other ancient writers, Persian law had some unique characteristics.
the laments of Noah to the ancient people said of it. One of those characteristics was this. Want of kidding. Once a meal provision kidding officially put into effect a law. No one, not even the king who put that law into effect, could ever change that law or would have broken it. It had to be carried out and enforced. Now the reason that was unique to Medo-Persian law is this. The Medo-Persians were convinced that their kings served as the spokesman for the gods. So that whatever king officially decreed was actually the gods through that king decreed that particular law. And according to the religious system of the Medo-Persians, whatever the God decreed was unchangeable. Because it was a divine decree. And divine decrees can never be reversed or revoked. Notice that statement, the law of the Medes and the Persians. I don't know about you, but ever since I've been a young student, I've heard that statement again and again and again when people have talked about something even in our modern day culture which cannot be changed, and somebody says, why is it that way? And the response of the word is, it's the law of the Medes and the Persians. Ever since that angel said, that it has been almost the colloquial, proverbial statement, even in our Western collection society, especially the proverbial, even our Western society. That it's that same idea that this was one of the unique features of the Medo-Persian law. Once the king passed it, it could not be revoked or reverted. And the rest, signed the decree, it became part of the law of the Medes and the Persians, and now it had to be enforced with no exception. The officials brought it. The scripture for the third division of Daniel chapter 6, which is contained in verses 10 through 14, and we could entitle this third division, Daniel ensnared by the trap. Daniel ensnared by the trap. Look at verse 10, please. Now when Daniel knew the document was found, notice the acted now of the students. to be able to call them slaves three times the salary.
And their reasoning is, well, it doesn't involve a moral absolute, so what does it matter if I stop this practice for a brief period of time? Daniel could very well have reasoned, it's only 30 days, and only matter, it only involves prayer. Certainly God would not be upset if I stopped praying to him just for 30 days. It's not a permanent setup, just for 30 days. And what would that matter as far as God is concerned, when it would spare his servant's life? But notice, Daniel is the kind of man who will not serve God just when it is expedient and beneficial for him to serve God. This involves a matter of service. And so he's determined that he will serve God even in non-absolute areas, no matter what it cost him personally. He knew the consequences, but he went ahead and continued on with his regular service, just as if that decree had never been passed by the king. And so he continues to pray three times a day toward Jerusalem, just as he had done before. Went to the same place. He could have gone maybe into an interior room of his home where they could never have heard him or never have seen him, but he didn't. He continued right at the same place where he had always prayed before. No change in his pattern. And notice the unique thing, not only was he petitioning God, but he was even giving thanks to God. Even in the midst of his life being threatened, for continuing to pray to God, he still continued to thank God for God's blessing to him. Look at verse 11. The schemers, the other officials who had laid this plot to trap Daniel, had their men planted. They wanted to see what this man of God would do. So verse 11, then these men came by agreement. They'd already determined this. They'd agreed upon this. And found Daniel making petition and supplication before his God. And I can imagine when they either heard or saw Daniel praying as he had before, they were elated. And probably, in great excitement, almost fell over each other to see who could be first to get into the king and steal on Daniel. So verse 12, then they approached and spoke before the king about the king's injunction. And this is what they said to the king. Did you not sign an injunction that any man who makes a petition to any god or man beside you, O king, for 30 days is to be cast into the lion's den? They wanted the king to reaffirm it with his own mouth, to trap him before they threw the punchline and told him who the first person was who violated his decree, because they knew Daniel was one of his favorites. And the king answered and said, the statement is true. According to the law of the Medes and Persians, which may not be revoked. Now they've got the king trapped. Then they answered and spoke before the king, verse 13, Daniel, who is one of the exiles from Judah, pays no attention to you, O king, or to the injunction which you signed, but keeps making his petition three times a day. Now notice, they had set it up in such a way that it looked as if their whole purpose for this decree was to direct the attention of everybody to the king. And so they said, this man Daniel, this Jew, who was one of your favorites, he doesn't pay attention to you, like all the other people of Iran. He doesn't pray to you, like they're doing for these 30 days. He's still doing the same thing he did in the past. He's praying three times a day to his God, Jehovah, and to that God alone. And I'm sure they waited to see the king's reaction. And the reaction came in verse 14. Then, as soon as the king heard this statement, he was deeply distressed. He knew he'd been trapped. And now he could see through the scheme of these officials. And I'm sure he saw the light right away why these men came in and asked him to sign this particular decree in the law. It wasn't because they were interested in the welfare of the king, but they had an ulterior motive to get rid of his favorite sub-ruler. And the king, being so distressed, set his mind on delivering Daniel, and even until sunset, he kept exerting himself to rescue him. Darius cared for Daniel so much, he didn't want to throw Daniel in the lion's den. He didn't want to execute this man. And so he did everything that he could as the head of his realm within the Medo-Persian Empire to revoke that Medo-Persian law. Now, what's the significance here that he did this until sunset? Well, here is the second unique feature of Medo-Persian law. And that is that according to Medo-Persian law, if one of the laws was broken, the guilty party had to be punished by sunset of the very day that the law was broken. Instant justice under the Medo-Persian law. The criminal, the violator of the law, was to be punished by sunset of the very day in which he had broken Medo-Persian law. And so Darius did everything he could within his own power to try to deliver Daniel and prevent him from being thrown into the lion's den up until sunset, but that was the deadline. And once sunset came, useless to exert his effort. And evidently, from what we read in verse 15, the other officials, recognizing what Darius was trying to do, kept bantering him and reminding him that what he was doing was wrong. We read verse 15, then these men came by agreement to the king and said to the king, recognize, O king, that it is a law of the Medes and Persians that no injunction or statute which the king establishes may be changed. And they just keep needling the king and reminding him until sunset, you can't revoke that law because of the law of the Medes and Persians. You must throw Daniel into the lion's den and send him to his death. This brings us to the next section of chapter 6, contained in verses 16 through 18, which we entitle Daniel in the Lion's Den. The king has done his best, but it is the law of the Medes and Persians. He could not rescue Daniel from the sentence. So, verse 16, then the king gave orders, and Daniel was brought in and cast into the lion's den. The Aramaic words, remember again, this section is written in the Aramaic language. The Aramaic word for den indicates this was a pit. Evidently, a large hole dug down into the ground, perhaps naturally formed, in which the lions had been placed. And there was an opening at the top. And any food or any person who was to be dropped down as a source of food to the lions would be dropped down through the hole in the top. No side doors from which they could possibly escape.
when they bring Daniel to the lion's den and are ready to cast him in, the most that Darius could do was express a wish. And again, the Aramaic language indicates this was a wish that he was expressing to Daniel. In essence, what he said to Daniel was this: may your God, whom you constantly serve, himself deliver you. That's the most he could hope for. He couldn't deliver Daniel. His last hope forbade that. His last hope is that Daniel's God possibly could deliver him. May I point out to you again, this is a pagan expression. May your God be able to deliver you. The implication is that to Darius' way of thinking, if he were to come the next morning and find that Daniel had been destroyed by the lions, this would be a clear-cut indicator that Jehovah, the God of Israel, was not capable of delivering his servant from this penalty of Medo-Persian law. It's a pagan expression. He's not sure whether Daniel's God has that ability or not. Daniel was thrown in. And to make certain that he cannot escape, nor that anyone else would come along to deliver him, pull him up out of that den, according to verse 17, a stone was brought and laid over the mouth of the den. And then the king pressed his signet ring into a seal upon that stone, and his noblemen did the same, so that nothing might be changed in regard to Daniel. In ancient times, once an official of a kingdom sealed with his ring, anyone who came and broke that seal without the king's permission was also to suffer the death penalty. Again, this was the king's way, since he had to obey Medo-Persian law, of guaranteeing that no one would rescue Daniel from his fate. And then the king went off, verse 18, to his palace, and he's so upset that he spent a miserable night. We're told that he didn't eat. No midnight snack for the king on this night. He wasn't interested in any food. No entertainment brought in. It was the custom in ancient times that the king could not sleep at night to bring in musicians, dancers, other forms of entertainment, hopefully to lull him into sleep. He wasn't interested in entertainment that night. He had a greater burden on his mind. And he could not sleep throughout the night. He's miserable over the way he'd been trapped. This brings us to verses 19 through 23, the next section of Daniel chapter 6, which could be entitled, Daniel Delivered from the Den. Early the next morning, at the crack of dawn, King Darius made a beeline to the den, according to verse 19. When he arrived there, the most that he could do was give out a very plaintive cry. He's hoping against hope that somehow Daniel has survived this ordeal. And in his plaintive cry, he cries out to Daniel, Daniel, servant of the living God, has your God, whom you constantly serve, been able to deliver you from the lions? I would kind of suspect that he was very pessimistic at this point and was expecting no sound out of that den unless it was one of the lions burping over the great meal the night before. But to his pleasant surprise, he hears Daniel's voice. O King, live forever. My God sent his angel and shut the lions' mouths, and they have not harmed me, inasmuch as I was found innocent before him and also toward you, O King. I have committed no crime. And Daniel indicates to this pagan king that Jehovah, the God of Israel, was indeed able to deliver his servant. He sent a special heavenly messenger, an angel, to deal with the lions, to shut their mouths so that they could not destroy this prophet of God. And he says to the king, in essence, the very fact that God has delivered me from this punishment ought to be conclusive proof to you that I did nothing in opposition to you or to try to hurt you in any way at all. The king was so delighted, verse 23, that he gave orders for Daniel to be taken up out of the den. So Daniel was taken up out of the den, and as they examined him, they found that no injury had been done to him because he had trusted in his God. Great stand of faith again on a servant of God. And God had honored that stand of faith. This brings us to the next section, which is contained in just one verse, verse 24. And that is the punishment of the plotters. The king then gave orders. And they brought those men who had maliciously accused Daniel. And they cast them, their children, and their wives into the lion's den. And they had not reached the bottom of the den before the lions overpowered them and crushed all their bones. Now that Jehovah, the God of Israel, had demonstrated that he is sovereign even over the laws of the Medes and the Persians, and that law has been fully satisfied because the sentence has been carried out, King Darius decides to punish the men who had schemed to trap Daniel. Now what we read here is not a pleasant picture. It is cruel. Darius not only commanded the screaming men to be thrown into the den, but every member of their families as well, wives and children. This is true to what we know of ancient Oriental rulers. Assyrian, Babylonian, Persian records indicate that this was often the case, that if a king wanted to execute a particular man within his realm, he would destroy the whole family together with that man. Those kings had practical reasons for doing that. They had, some of them had learned by experience that if they killed only the guilty man, that perhaps later on his wife, out of vengeance, would plot an assassination of that king. Or perhaps that man's children would bear bitterness in their heart against the king until they would grow old enough to plot the murder of that king. And so for practical reasons, these ancient Oriental potentates wiped out the whole family so that they would not have to worry, perhaps in future months or years, that somebody would be lurking in the shadows from that family, attempting to put them to death. Then records the reaction of the lions in pouncing upon these people immediately and destroying them, probably to emphasize the fact that his deliverance alive from the lion's den was not due to the fact that these lions were so old that they didn't care anymore about people being thrown into them, or that they'd been so overfed that they weren't hungry the night that Daniel had been dropped into their presence. They were still very young and virile and hungry, and so they ripped to shreds these enemies who had been dropped into their midst. The next section is contained in verses 25 through 27, which we could entitle the King's New Decree. And again, an amazing thing. Here is a pagan Gentile man, now a Median. Formerly it was a Babylonian king, Nebuchadnezzar, but now a Median Gentile man who has had a confrontation with Jehovah the God of Israel. And he's been tremendously impressed as a result. And so we read, then Darius the king wrote to all the peoples, nations, and men of every language who were living in all the land. And this is what he wrote. May your peace abound. I make a decree that in all the dominion of my kingdom, men are to fear and tremble before the God of Daniel. For he is the living God and enduring forever. And his kingdom is one which will not be destroyed. And his dominion will be forever. He delivers and rescues and performs signs and wonders in heaven and on earth. He has also delivered Daniel from the power of the lions. This pagan Gentile ruler is impressed with the fact that Jehovah, the God of Israel, is a living God. He's not a dead God of wood and stone, as the pagan gods were. He is an eternal God who never had a beginning and will never have an end. The gods that were made by human hands had a beginning, and they've also had ends, but not this God. He's impressed with the fact that Daniel's God rules sovereignly over the dominion of men on planet Earth, and that he's demonstrated that by delivering his great servant to what seemed to be certain death. And this brings us to the last part of Daniel chapter 6, verse 28, which we can entitle a summary statement. Daniel writes, "So this Daniel enjoyed success in the reign of Darius and in the reign of Cyrus the Persian." You may recall, at the end of chapter 1, we had such a summary statement that indicated that God preserved Daniel alive through the whole Babylonian reign until Medo Persia took control. Here's another summary statement, again, a testimony to the sovereignty of God, that again, God kept the servant preserved and alive throughout the reign of Darius and during the reign of the ultimate king of the Medo Persian Empire, King Cyrus. God's sovereign rule over Gentile law demonstrated. Again, there's great application for the people of God today. And that is that even if it costs the people of God are to serve Jehovah, the God of Israel, whether it is expedient and personally profitable to do so, or whether it is not. We are not to change our service to God because the world dictates that we do so, or makes it inconvenient for us to do so. We are to remain faithful in our service to Him. And again, a lot of the results of that service to rest in His hands.
A free catalog listing other titles in our cassette library will be sent to you upon request. Simply address your request to the Friends of Israel, Post Office Box 123, West Collinswood, New Jersey, 08107.